Welcome to What's Eric Eating? Culture Map's bi-weekly look at all things Houston bars and restaurants. I'm your host, Culture Map editor Eric Sandler. Today on the show, I'll have a conversation with someone in the food world I think you'll want to hear from. Joining us for the third year in a row to talk about season four of The Bear, the FX series set in the world of Chicago restaurants. He is the chef owner of Theodore Rex, a Food and Wine Vestu chef recipient, a James Beard Award winner, and a partner in Thoreau Fair Hospitality, and the winner of our Date Night Draft, Volume 1. Justin Yu, welcome back to the show. How are you?
The Date Night Draft, I think, is probably the highlight of my career. That's a big win for me. But I'm well. How are you?
I mean, of all of your significant achievements in the world of food, I think it probably had the least competition in the sense that you only had to beat five of us, but it was well earned. I now think about dates in terms of high-low because of your draft strategy.
It's the way to go, for sure.
All right. Well, as I said, this has become a bit of a tradition that you come on the show to talk about The Bear. And I think, you know, for the first two, even the third season, there was a lot of restaurant action, right? In the first season,
yeah,
Carmi, Jeremy Allen White's character, has taken over his brother's Chicago sandwich shop, and he's learning to run the sandwich shop and interact with the existing employees, including one of his brother's oldest friends. And you know, and then in season two, we see the restaurant kind of evolve and as they prepare to bring this fine dining restaurant to fruition. And then obviously season three is very focused on opening the restaurant and interacting with the larger culinary world. Lots of cameos from chefs, lots of references to the larger culinary world. Season four is a little different. And obviously, let me just say, spoilers throughout. If you have not watched season four of The Bear, Justin and I are going to talk about some other stuff towards the end, so maybe fast forward a bit. But if you have not watched season four of The Bear and you want to watch season four of The Bear, from this point, spoilers galore. So consider yourself warned.
There we go.
But this season was a little different in the sense that there's still action at the restaurant, but it's not really about the rest. Like, there's some restaurant moments, but it's less focused on the technical, the cooking. We don't see them drinking from, you know, plastic quart containers anymore. We don't have those kind of, you know, knife skills, that kind of stuff anymore. It's a little bit different in that sense.
It's like the restaurant world at large, right? It is, you know, what's going on in the lives of the employees at the restaurant and how they interact with the restaurant, and that big weight of expectation, that big weight of not letting everybody down that you work with, and that big weight of how do you balance that with regular life, which is a really consistent issue, problem, great thing about working in restaurants.
Right. I mean, really in episode one, the restaurant is kind of presented with the challenges that will sort of govern the narrative structure of the season, which is that Uncle Jimmy can no longer support the restaurant financially. He's given them basically 3 months of support, at which point they will either have to be profitable or they will have to close. And at the same time, they got a review in the Chicago Tribune that criticized it for being too chaotic, for changing the menu too much, for not having enough consistency in both the front and the back of the house. And so they have to respond to both of those challenges. And you know, the big change, I think, is that, you know, cost of ingredients becomes an issue. And so, you know, the number of components on each dish has to be reduced, and the way that they prepare the dishes has to be modified. And so I thought that might be a good jumping off point for you. Kind of talk about the way that actually happens in restaurants where, yeah, you're combating these financial challenges.
Yeah, I mean, at least the way that I handle food initially and how I start to think about food a lot of times is just with one singular ingredient or one singular idea. It's very ingredient focused, and a lot of times you kind of both start and stop with whether or not that dish can actually work based on that ingredient. So obviously, you know, the more expensive it is, there is, you know, in general, cost of goods for a dish should run somewhere around 33 to, you know, like 30 to 33%. And sometimes, especially with, you know, that it's really pertinent to today's restaurant struggles because the cost of ingredients, especially base ingredients and proteins and beef, has skyrocketed. The things that, you know, like a steak costing $95 to the guest, you know, most restaurants aren't even making half of that cost back just because the cost of beef has gone up so much. And, you know, there's an expectation of the way how much you're going to spend at a restaurant, and, you know, trying to match that with what the ingredients are with the way that, you know, costs have gone up is really, really difficult. And so I actually tend to, I related to that part quite a bit because, you know, you, throughout your career, you start to kind of find out ways to be a little bit more profitable, a little bit more profitable. Generally, very early in your career, you're like, I don't give a fuck. I don't care. I want to put what I want to put on a plate, and it doesn't matter how much money I make. These are things that I want to do. And I think Carmi has to deal with that. I think they talk about the chaos of the menu, and, you know, chaos that I remember from when we were starting our first restaurant, Oxheart. And the general story goes, if you ask any of the cooks that were there, is that dishes changed every other day, for better or worse. Sometimes we might have put out dishes that weren't really fully thought out, but it was just what we could get our hands on at that point.
Right. And I think, you know, we even talked about this last year. I think that the Bear had some aspirations of earning a Michelin star, and that was going to be very difficult to achieve because the guide really prioritizes consistency, maybe even above creativity. And if you're changing the menu all the time, there's no way that you could be consistent in your execution from service to service.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and also too, it's almost a little selfish to think that way, right? You know, because even if you are talented enough to cook something different every day and to make it delicious, changing someone's prep list on a day-to-day basis, even hours before service, just for the sake of change, as opposed for the sake of, and for more your sake and your ego, is really, really difficult. It's difficult to wrangle a team together to, you know, it's have that expectation like, oh, you got to get on my level. A lot of times it's not dumbing it down. It's learning how to, being a chef, you know, I see it very differently these days than when I first started in restaurants. It's not what the best that you can do. It's the best that you can get your team to execute on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the really kind of nice narrative arcs of the season is Tina's progression as a line cook. We see her struggling to complete a certain pasta dish in the correct amount of time. You know, she's told she has 3 minutes and she's closer to 5 minutes when she starts, and she figures it out over the course of the season. She pre-portions her ingredients. She heats her pan beforehand. She does all these little things. And then by the end of the season, she's where she needs to be. And I think, you know, I thought maybe you might have some thoughts on that process in terms of the timing of service and also of, you know, trusting your line cooks or encouraging your line cooks to improve themselves and their skills while they're working for you.
Yeah, there's a good amount of, it's trust, but also training and the ability for you to have them understand what each dish means, what the way it should taste and why, and how fast or slow it should go. And probably the reasons behind that, you know, a long time ago when we were being trained, we were just told to cook the food and not really be given a reason as to why it should be done that way. It should just be done that way because that's the best way to do it. Whereas, you know, we try our very best these days to explain the reasoning behind the fact that there is a dish that has less components in it so that it is, you know, 30 seconds faster to plate up, so that that ends up being a thirst where you could get another turn on a table. You know, I think that even, you know, this is always a little bit of a touchy subject, but even that idea of pastry chefs and pastry and dessert, you know, and dessert wines, you know, I love a meal at the end of the night where you get a beautifully plated dessert and a little bit of coffee and espresso and a little bit of dessert wine. But that's, a 30 to 45 minute, time crunch that sometimes the restaurant needs the table back so that they can get another turn on it, not for the sake of making money, but for the sake of keeping up with costs, So, especially in the last 5 years where costs have just risen so dramatically, that 30 minute time period every single night, 5 to 7 days a week could be the life or death of the restaurant.
Yeah. And I think we sort of see that, I think it's episode 8 where, the computer, Uncle Jimmy's sort of sidekick and financial advisor, meets with Natalie Carmi's sister and co-owner about the restaurant's financial prospects. And he says, keeping the pastry chef was a good idea because he becomes a value add, to the point that he's named a best new chef by Food and Wine.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun to see. Because also it could mean that, if you have a great pastry program, especially for a place like The Bear, which is a tasting menu restaurant, right? So having a really, fantastic pastry program is such an added plus. And I know that, especially chatting with pastry chefs and running our own restaurants and trying to figure out a way to have less specialized people that deserve that amount of money that they have trained so many years to attain a level of execution. How does that all fit in the puzzle? And I think that's a major component of this season is they seem to really enjoy what they're doing, but it's just finding the right pieces to the puzzle to actually make the restaurant profitable. Even being profitable is extremely difficult. That's generally why we always tell people who ask us, well, I want to open up a restaurant. What do I got to do? And the joke is always, well, don't do it. Right. And so, because finding all the right pieces left and right, and putting all those together is extremely difficult.
Right. It's the famous joke about restaurants is, do you know how to make a little money in the restaurant business?
Right.
So it's start with a lot of money.
Right.
So, and everyone in the restaurant business that I tell that, even though I'm sure they've all heard that joke a million times before, the reason that they laugh is because there's something sort of fundamentally true about it. The other couple of restaurant moments that we see, they spend a bit of time in, I think it's episode 3, Sydney creates, hemmed in by these cost constraints and the need to reduce the number of ingredients per dish. We see Sydney create a seared scallop with some sort of aerated foam type thing. And I was just wondering what you thought of that. Apparently, we're told in the life of the show that dish does very well on social media and it's getting a lot of good notoriety. But I just wondered what you thought of it.
Well, I don't know. Maybe foams are back. I haven't cooked with foams in a really long time. So as far as like that dish goes, it's probably new and fun again because it kind of harkens back to when it's a little bit older. The dish itself was really pretty. It looked like it photographs really well, and that's something as cooks and chefs we have to think about these days because a lot of the besides reading Eric Sandler on Culture Map, a lot of times the way that people get their restaurant information is by going to Instagram and looking at the photos of the dining room and seeing the ways that, it's not just Yelp anymore or Google reviews. It's that's the first thing I do. I go to the geotag for the restaurant and I look at the food and I get really excited about it. If you're to talk about the dish pragmatically, it's like it is probably like it seems like a 2010s dish. With a little bit of foam on it. Usually that was done for a lighter sauce that would stay on the plate a little bit more. It was made of fun of a lot back in the day. And it kind of went out of style. And I've seen a few more. And there's where a lot of like the new cool stuff come from. I actually saw one today, a chef named Bo Beck had a roast chicken dish with a foam on it. And I thought it was interesting to see that kind of come back in vogue.
Yeah, I had a mushroom and almond Vulevent at Le Jardinet last week that came topped with a foam. And of course, I got the DM from someone who was like, ugh, foams, they just look like spit. It's like, okay, look, if we're not going to have this whole debate over again. You know, we're just, you know, can we just, if it doesn't look appealing to you, don't eat it.
I mean, yeah, I mean, it's a great way to get something that is already intense without having, it's a good use and tool. It's also one of those things where, if you understand what you're doing and why it ends up on the plate, then no big deal. If you rely on it constantly so that you can name it something different, like being different for the sake of being different, that's probably not a good reason to put something on the plate.
All right. And then the other thing I wanted to ask you about is, you know, as much as this season really is about Carmi coming to the realization that, you know, maybe restaurants aren't, that's not his future, or that at the very least he needs a break. It's also Sydney kind of deciding about her future and whether to stay at the Bear or to join a new restaurant being created by Adam Shapiro, who was the chef de cuisine of Ever, the fine dining restaurant where, you know, cousin Mikey like learns to love service, learns to love front of the house in the episode called Forks in season two, which is probably my favorite episode of the whole series. But
yeah,
you know, what did you think of Sydney's decision? Because I can see as a young cook the opportunity to go into a, like you're at the Bear and you're struggling financially, and Carmi is brilliant but deeply flawed in the way that he relates to people, and this guy with a ton of money is offering you everything that you could conceivably want, professionally, control, you know, a say in the menu, a role in hiring, a beautiful environment to work in, an open kitchen, et cetera, et cetera. So what were your kind of thoughts about that debate? And obviously, ultimately, Sydney decides to stay at the Bear. But yeah. What did you think of that whole plot?
I actually really enjoyed it, because this constantly happens in the restaurant business. You know, we become both friends, but then also fans of people that are working under other people. And you kind of envision sometimes like, hey, if I open up something new, maybe I want to have this person work for me. And how are we going to get them to move over? You know, the ability to create is one thing. Obviously, money is a big thing. You know, the kind of promise of work-life balance is another thing. And, you know, I think those are ways that people kind of get people to move from one place to another. I mean, that being said, you know, I think that the dynamic is really interesting, because, you know, Sydney is always like generally very conflicted. There's like a lot of there's a lot of inside of her. She's like, she wants to work with this person, but this person is causing a lot of chaos in her life, and he's trying to give in, and she's trying to adjust things so that everybody is just a little bit better. And, you know, there is one thing to kind of be said that, you know, running a kitchen and being a chef and being a really good chef teaches you really like nothing about running a business. It's actually kind of backwards, that you excel at cooking is almost like the exact opposite way that you excel at running a business. And so, you know, for me personally, who's had to take a big step back from the kitchens on the day-to-day basis to learn how to run restaurants, I think that I related to that quite a bit. But that being said, I think that, you know, what you learn about cooking and what I think that that you see here at the Bear, which I think is like really relatable, is that, you know, that idea of work-life balance is great. But sometimes that balance should be tilted towards what you're really loving and really into. And sometimes, you know, if you really want to kind of hit a level of maybe notoriety or the amount of work that needs to be done, there's nothing that you can do to really step yourself outside of the restaurant. So work-life balance sometimes for a restaurant is not, you know, a feasible thing, except that you realize that balance really means that it's balanced in the way that you get to do the creative things that you want to do. And that tends to lean a little bit more towards work.
Right. And I think we see what unites the cooks at the Bear is a desire for greatness, for some sort of excellence or creativity or ingenuity. You know, we see Marcus in season three, his mother passes away. In season four, his father keeps calling him, texting him, wanting to spend time with him. And Marcus doesn't have a lot of time for that. You know, Marcus right. is at his happiest when he's at the restaurant, when he's creating new desserts, when he's working with Luca. And so for him to get that Food and Wine Best New Chef and then to be able to text the web link to his dad, this is the restaurant I work at. This is what I did. It's a real achievement for him and a real moment for him.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you don't really get there by, you know, working 40 hours a week. That's kind of what I tell at least the cooks over at T-Rex is like, you don't get to where you want to go by working 40 hours a week at a restaurant.
Yeah. David Chang basically said the same thing when he was in Houston last year doing a presentation with Chris Shepherd. Like, work-life balance is great, but if you want to be truly great at your job, you have to sacrifice that at least for a certain period of time.
Yeah, at least for a little bit. And there's also ways that when you get there that, you know, the best thing you could possibly do is to teach other people how that balance came across or how you came across that balance a little bit more in life. Personal life or like my work-life balance life is that, you know, sometimes you got to trim that excess, just to use, you know, culinary analogy, is you got to trim the excess. You got to trim all those bits, you know, make you stay that extra 15 minutes. Should you have to be there that extra 15 minutes? If not, especially if like, could you just teach somebody else to have done that, to, you know, have them learn a little bit more. And so that balance comes with a lot of repetition and it takes a really long time to get all that repetition done.
No, absolutely. And then I guess we should talk about the final episode of the season, which is called Goodbye, in which it is revealed that Carmi has made the decision that he won't be a financial partner in the restaurant and that his time there is limited, that he's going to help them get the ship righted financially, and then he's going to step away. And you've actually, I mean, you closed Oxheart to turn it into T-Rex, but you've always been involved in your restaurants. You've never started something that you then stepped away from. So I wondered what you thought of that, or if you thought about peers that maybe had been in the restaurant business and then either stepped away from it or took a break from it or anything like that.
I mean, that I think that there's a point, I mean, this is most any career, but there's especially for something as intense as, you know, cooking, running a restaurant, being a chef, like sometimes you got to kind of, you've crossed that bridge and you got to make a decision of, is this the way that I want to live my life, or is there another life that I want to live, or is there a better way that I want to live my life? So you could just constantly stick yourself in that restaurant for 70 to 80 hours a week, 90 hours a week, 100 hours a week sometimes, and to really grind it out, be that martyr where if something is broken, you're always there to fix it, never teach somebody else how to do it. Or you could learn how to work with other people, or you can make a decision that is like, hey, I don't want to always be on call. Like, you know, I'm sure that, you know, if you've been to T-Rex or even a BLT and I've never been in the kitchen at Squabble, that is Mark's kitchen, you'll see that, like, I had to learn how to allow myself to let people other do their job and to be get better than I am at that job. And, you know, and then some people, but what that means also too is like 4 o'clock in the morning, you might get that phone call that the door is broken and you have to drive over to figure out how everybody can lock up. You're going to get that phone call at, you know, from the AC guy that they're on their way to the restaurant because that's when they start their day. You're almost always on call. And even when you're halfway across the world, you get phone calls about dumb shit that you don't want to deal with. And you're just always on call. And some people don't want to do that. You've seen plenty of people step away from that. A lot of them go work in food and other aspects. Honestly, like a lot, you know, back, it's interesting. The best kitchen that I have ever been a part of is a restaurant called Ubuntu that I was at. It was a one Michelin star, all vegetable focused restaurant in Napa Valley. Every single one there was a killer. And I mean, when I say killer, I mean, as fast as they could possibly be, as efficient as they possibly be, that food was beautiful. I can't think of one person that has worked that line with me that is still working in a restaurant kitchen. Some of them are chefs at Google. Some of them are private chefs. Some of them have left the industry altogether. One of them is a bartender. And, you know, some of them are still get to be involved in food, but they have and they get to do that creation, you know, in less of a restaurant setting. But it's food still gets to be a part of their life. It's just not in the setting of a restaurant.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for Carmi specifically, leaving Chicago, traveling the world, working at, you know, we see him at the French Laundry. We see him at a restaurant that we think is basically supposed to be 11 Madison Park. We know that he went to Copenhagen and worked at Noma. So, you know, leaving home and exploring the world was both a positive decision in that allowed him to develop the skills that he needed to become a truly great chef, a James Beard winner, a Food and Wine Best New Chef winner. But it also allowed him to get away from his family. You know, we see him in the Fishes episode, the Christmas dinner at his mother's house. How toxic that family dynamic could be, and that it inhibits his ability to relate to Claire, his on again off again girlfriend type. You know, it makes it hard for him to apologize to Sydney when he's made a mistake. We see him rage in the walk-in cooler at the end of season two, and you know, we see him in therapy. We see his mother's obviously been in therapy. You know, that episode, I think it's episode 8 of this season, where he cooks for his mother and she apologizes to him for the things that she did. And he sort of makes his, you know, maybe not fully makes his peace with her, but they come to some level of mutual respect, right? Some, you know,
right.
She says to him, "I don't know you very well and you don't know me very well." And as someone who's close to his mother, that hurt. I mean, that's such a terrible thing for a mother to say to a son,
right?
"I don't know you very well." That's awful. And that's what he's had to overcome. And if cooking has been his refuge, then yeah, he's going to need, like, to figure out how to be a fully integrated, happy person. He's going to need to give that up for a little while in pursuit of a larger, you know, quality, better mental health, quality of life.
I mean, it just, that's the last thing that you said is the most true. I think that restaurants has made him happy. And that he's only known a certain way for such a long period of time, and it's no longer making him happy. And that is something that you have to, and it's, again, for any job, that's something you have to come to terms with. It's like, is this still making me happy, or is it making me happy enough to live the rest of my life also? And, you know, especially too, as chefs also get older, you know, do you want to be chained to that, you know, that proverbial chain to the stove chef? Moving forward. And I think that he can't separate being in a restaurant and not being chained to the stove from not being at the restaurant or being not at the restaurant at all. So for him, it's a really hard line in the sand. Like, I can't do this and be a regular person. Where honestly, there's a way to do both. I was out on a Saturday this week. I'm out on a few Saturdays, quite a bit of Saturdays. And I know plenty of chefs that are able to do the same thing and keep the quality high of their restaurants and their bars and all that. So.
Right. But we should say it took you a long time to be comfortable being out on a Saturday. This is not, you know, when you opened Oxhard in 2012 or 2013,
yeah,
you were not out on a Saturday. You were chained to the stove.
No. I mean, took a while. It took a lot of me. I had to stop being hard-headed. And then also too, it's like, you know, learn how to trust people with the work that they're just as good at, as you are. And trust is obviously the biggest thing when that happens, and trying to build that mutual trust is extremely, extremely important. I feel so lucky that I get to work with so many people that are so talented.
All right. Well, I think this is everything that I wanted to talk to you about in this season of The Bear. Did you have anything that I haven't brought up that you want to mention?
I mean, maybe just as like a small thing, I think the one thing, it's not that I wouldn't go to The Bear if it were there, but you know, I think it kind of pushed that one little thing about, especially tasting menu restaurant, Michelin starred restaurants. This mostly happens in Europe, but like they mentioned a whole bunch of restaurants that were like, they live on stages, and I just don't like restaurants that are like that. There are plenty of restaurants. A lot of them are very well rated, and you know, the majority of their workforce comes from free labor, and they kind of joke about that a little bit in there. And I just call bullshit on that. However much I think that it is fun to go to these restaurants that where every detail is looked after, maybe think about whether or not that detail is looked after by somebody who more or less paid to be there.
Yeah. And I don't know that we really have any restaurants at Houston that are like that. I think for the most part, the people that you see in kitchens around town are being paid for their labor, because that idea of the unpaid stage or having, you know, a dozen people stay with you for several months unpaid as part of their culinary education has really fallen out of favor in, you know,
well,
kind of.
Hold on. This is also coming from a guy who did a TED talk about how you should stage. So I'm just maybe overcorrecting myself. And as somebody who did work for free for too long. But I think honestly too, what I loved about this season too is like it also gave a little bit of a guideline to what I think is the most interesting and dynamic food in the world is that's food that comes from, again, that proverbial trimming away, having limitations on how much you can charge, given what your dining room's like, and having limitations on what that food is. I think the best creativity, and you see that all everywhere here in Houston, where it's like the best creativity comes from not having an unlimited budget. The best creativity and the most delicious food comes from people that are just like cooking their hearts out and are able to communicate that through their food.
No, absolutely. And, you know, we talk about Casa Emma on the show all the time, but there's a ceiling to what people are going to want to pay for breakfast and lunch. And what Nicholas and Stephanie have achieved is, and the price that they've achieved it is really remarkable. And that's why I think it's one of the best restaurants in Houston.
I wouldn't even say remarkable. It is crazy. It is crazy how good that food is. And I've only been the once, unfortunately. I wish I'd gone more often, but every single dish had so much depth of flavor, obviously had a lot of care put into it. And everybody seemed just so happy there doing what they were doing.
Let me shift the conversation just a little bit. Where else have you been recently? What have you been excited about?
I mean, you talk about it all the times, but I want to give always a shout out to Jacques and Max over at Basso. Maybe not even a shout out. No one needs to shout them out. They it's just obvious, right? Their food is of such high quality. It's so interesting at all times. Like, I know that this is like, there's like a third iteration now of the endive and horseradish dish. It's in peach season. But it's interesting and fun to see like a dish that starts out almost like a little bit too sweet that like rounds itself into form with the heat of the horseradish at the end. It's both interesting, but also just really fucking delicious. Obviously, Kasama was a really fantastic, time. I'm so sorry that it closed, but you know, whenever he shows back up, please go and support. Chica Han was a really amazing meal that I had. Is a Filipino tasting menu. We had about 4 or 5 months ago. Whenever Andrew Musico pops back up, I'll be there to eat his food, and not really to like try to get more business, but like again, like I said before, I I've never been the chef over at Squabble, no matter if people try to attribute any of the food to me, it's never been mine. So Mark, I've been eating his food for years, and this like Squabble, I went a couple nights ago for dinner, and it'd been a while since I'd been. And it just hit, every single dish just hit, even the ones where like I thought I would have, like I would squabble with, like, were so good. The calabaza squash dish with the salsa matcha was good. And honestly, if you love oxtails, that oxtail dish, that's in, it looks like it is a little bit too expensive, but it's not. It is so good. You have these really sticky, beautiful glazed oxtails with a very, very airy cornbread with delicious rice with it. And it's just everything I wanted in a dish. And then also too, got to take some home and then like eat it with eggs next day. So just a little shout out to Mark. I know that. Yeah.
No. And Bobby, when Bobby Hugel was on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, he and I talked about Squabble because I had just been back after a period of time away for brunch and had French toast and roasted oysters and the potatoes with the trout roe and everything else. And it's so consistently satisfying. And, you know, you're right. I get excited about new restaurants, right? I've been to Milton's 3 or 4 times. I've been to Basso even more than that. I'm planning my second visit to Latuli, you know, all of these other things. But I have been being a little bit more deliberate and trying to go back to some of the places that I really love that I don't always make time for. And so Squabble was very much on that list. And I really do like that it's open for brunch on both Saturday and Sunday, because that just makes it that much easier to go there. And it really, it's such a great place. And you know, I know Mark got some love in the Tastemaker Awards a couple of years ago, and I was happy we were able to do that for him. But he does maybe fly just a little bit under the radar compared to some of the other top chefs in Houston. So yes, this is your reminder to go to Squabble.
Absolutely.
And then let me just ask you, you know, what's new at T-Rex? What are you working on?
Well, T-Rex is about to go through, I wouldn't say a major change, but definitely a change in its menu and menu style. I think that with most modern restaurants and with restaurants that, you know, try to live a little bit more on that modern edge, you kind of have to always be retooling yourself and looking at the menu and looking out nationally and internationally about, you know, is this the food that you want to continue to be serving? Is it still bringing people in? And, you know, when we redid this menu after COVID, you know, Frank, the current chef de cuisine, and I worked on it pretty heavily. And I thought it's still to me like one of the best menus or probably the best menu that we've ever put out. And, you know, over the years, you know, it's trying to working through a lot of the issues in restaurants. It's like it's gotten a little, to me, really, really delicious, but a little like parts of it are a little bit stale. So sometimes what you got to do is reinvent a little bit. So we're making a big change as far as like all the favorites are going away. So like the tomato toast will no longer be there. The butter cake is going away. The grass-fed beef dumplings are not going to be there. Not to say that they can't come back for, you know, little hits every here and here and there. But we're going to kind of do a big menu retool and a big flip. The style of dining will be a little bit different, but still kind of just that it's fine dining, but it's not, but it's very relaxed. A lot of fun references, but still kind of in that, hey, we cook very French with a lot of personality into it.
Yeah. So people have their fair warning. How long do we have until the tomato toast goes away?
The 1st of September is when our new menu comes out. So we're giving ourselves a little bit of time to make sure that all the dishes that we're thinking of are going to work out really well.
And you usually take a couple of weeks off in the middle of the summer, right? So that's got to be coming
up soon. Well, you know, we can when we can. We always try to have a break at one during winter and one during summer. We're going to have a week-long break from so our last day of service will be Sunday the 24th, and then we'll be back in the 1st of September.
With an all new menu, or with a mostly new menu.
With a mostly new, well, you know what? It'll be an all new menu, and it'll be good.
Let me ask you one other thing, because you keep posting them, and I still haven't been in to try them. But tell me about these chicken wings that you've been running on Sundays.
So a fun thing that we've been doing is ingredients that take a lot of just detail work. You know, the yield is really low, or like the cost is really high. And one of those things is chicken wings. Just so you know, I probably am the pickiest, but will eat any chicken wings in the entire world. I love buffalo wings. It's my favorite food in the entire world. I probably would be you'd be aghast at my Wingstop orders, how many of them happen throughout the year, especially since I watch someone. But if we're going to do something at T-Rex, we want to do it as like kind of like that really, really like detailed sort of way, and to make it as delicious as you possibly can. I think the best part of the wing is the flat, and partly because you've got a lot of that cartilage in there, and it's both tender on the inside and then like really gets really crispy on the outside because it's flat. And so what you have to do is bone out the wing. And so we bone out the small joint of the wing, and then we fry it, and then we air dry it, and then we fry it at a high temperature afterwards. And then just to keep on pushing the fact that sometimes these dishes take too much time, as like we do take dried tomato skins from making the tomato toast, toasted dried mushrooms and toasted kombu, and make a little powder to make it a little bit more umami for it. So it's a chicken wing, but it's a chicken wing that like took a really, really long time to get there. And we don't buy just chicken wings too. We take off all the wings from the chickens that we get from Jolly Farms. So that's why we can only have them we'll get enough wings once a month to run the chicken wings for a night, because there's only two wings per bird, you know?
Yeah. They're chicken wings that have been to graduate school.
Right.
These are not your regular chicken wings. So where is your go-to? Like, do you have a, like, obviously you can't make your own chicken wings all the time. So sure. I hope it's not Wingstop. Like, surely you're going local for your chicken wings.
But it is Wingstop. Wingstop is the best wings consistently in Houston. Don't roll your eyes at me. Wingstop is the most consistent for sure. I've had this conversation so many times.
You're right down the street from Roostar. They make great wings.
I'm not saying they don't make great wings. I'm saying that like in a pinch, when I'm craving wings, it is, you get the 15 piece, half of it is lemon pepper, the other half is buffalo hot. I tend to issue those fries because they put sugar on them, but so I go with just like extra veggie sticks to make myself feel better about myself. But yeah, Wingstop's Roostar has great wings. You know, like Winnie's has fucking fantastic wings. I just had the wings from Berwick's Bird of Paradise. It's a new bar that just opened, what, Friday?
Yes, it opened on July 4th. We haven't even talked about it on the show yet, but yes.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. But
No, it's fine. article shortly after this podcast drops on Tuesday morning, there will be a Culture Map article about Berwick's Birds of Paradise, or apparently, as we're all calling it, Bebop.
It is Bebop, and, you know, man, they had these jerk chicken wings that were really, really delicious, and also a really fucking good burger. You got to have a good burger. So, not to mention just great vibes. Just felt great in there. I live in the Heights, so I feel as if I'm going to be there too often.
Yeah, I rolled in on Saturday, ran into you and your girlfriend and some friends, and yeah, beautiful room. I did not eat. And I only had one drink, but yeah, Berwick's Birds of Paradise, or we're going to call it Bebop. That's what we're calling it.
Bebop. I think you got to call it Bebop.
All right. This is your new destination cocktail bar in the Heights, at least until Bobby Hugel and Jackie Schramm open their destination cocktail bar in the Heights.
Super excited to have Jackie back in the family too. Oh, very, very excited about it. It's a good time to drink in the Heights.
Yeah. A very good. Yeah. Starduster, the kid. You know, to go along with Easy's and Johnny's and all the other places we love. Yeah, it's a good time to drink in the Heights.
All right. BLT.
And BLT, of course. And you have the beef. How long do we have to go to Better Luck Tomorrow and have the Chicago beef sandwich?
Oh yeah, so we always run for a month the Chicago beef sandwich, or it's our version of the Italian beef. It is going to be running until the 20th of this month. And then we started Taco Tuesdays. We haven't had a new chef de cuisine this year, Hector Gonzalez. He is the sous chef here at Theodore Rex for a year and change. And he took over as chef de cuisine over at Better Luck Tomorrow. So for the summer, we're running Taco Tuesday, and they've been killing it. They've been doing such a great job.
Any final thoughts? Anything you want to plug on your way out?
No plugs. Just wanted to say that I look forward to performing really well in our fantasy football this year.
I had a terrible fantasy football year. So if my prospects don't improve this season, I think that's it for me. I may just call it a good 20-year run. And thank you very much.
You're not allowed to. You're the commissioner. Commissioners can't be
there. That is true. I am stuck with that league forever. All right. Justin Yu, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
You can follow me on Instagram at Eric Sandler. Keep it locked on culturemap.com for all the latest Houston bar and restaurant news. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back next week.